Good day. Welcome to another episode of the Audible Local Ledger Reads to the Blind podcast. You can get more information at audiblelocalledger.org. Stay tuned for today's reading.
Hello, this is Carolyn reading to you from the Cape Cod Times on Wednesday, March 13th. As always, we'll start today with the local weather. Today will be a partly sunny day with highs of 49 degrees. Tonight will be cloudy with a passing shower. Lows will be 38 degrees. The sun rose this morning at 6:56 a.m. and will set tonight at 6:46 p.m. Tomorrow, Thursday, March 14th, will be a partly sunny, partly cloudy day. Highs will be 52 degrees and lows 41 degrees. Friday will be a mostly cloudy day with a couple of showers around. Highs 48 degrees and lows 42 degrees. Saturday will have some low clouds, but then perhaps some sunshine later. Highs will be 46 degrees and lows 37 degrees. And finally, on Sunday, it will be a cloudy day with rain and drizzle in the afternoon. The highs will be 51 degrees and the lows 40 degrees. And next, in other local news, we'll go to the lottery. The numbers game for yesterday, Tuesday, March 12th, at the midday drawing, were 2, 6, 3, 2. Again, 2, 6, 3, 2. The evening drawing for yesterday, March 12th, was 6, 2, 7, 2. Once again, that is 6, 2, 7, 2. The mass cash numbers for yesterday, Tuesday, March 12th, were 4, 8, 15, 28, 34. Mega Millions numbers for yesterday, Tuesday, March 12th, were 2, 16, 31, 57, 64, the bonus number of 24. And last but not least, the Lucky for Life numbers for yesterday, March 12th, were 3, 13, 24, 36, 44, with a lucky ball of 11. If you played any of these games, we wish you the best of luck. And now we'll go to the front page local story in today's Cape Cod Times. That story is entitled, Housing Production Plans Present Challenges. Some Cape Towns have them and some don't. By Zain Razak, Cape Cod Times, USA Today Network. Since the pandemic, pressures on Chatham's housing stock have gone up, according to Housing and Sustainability Director Gloria McPherson. Prices have gone up, and when prices at the market rate go up, that means the gap between what's affordable and what's market rate gets even bigger, McPherson said. So it's harder to achieve your goals. The town is looking for help from residents at a March 20th meeting to develop a new housing production plan and a housing needs assessment. Chatham's last housing production plan was completed in 2018 and expired in November. McPherson said now is especially a good time to rethink these types of plans because so much has changed in housing since COVID-19. McPherson said she expects a new housing production plan to be ready by the end of July. A housing production plan is a municipality's approach to understanding its housing needs and putting strategies in place to address them. Plans are valid for 5 years after approval from the State Executive Office of Housing and Livable Communities. Communities are not required to have housing, to have the plans, said Rachel Heller, CEO of Citizens Housing and Planning Association, known as CHAPA or CHAPA. She called them incredibly helpful documents to understand the challenges people are facing. Housing production plans typically examine how many people are housing cost burdened, meaning that they pay more than 30% of their income for housing costs, Heller said. It can be powerful for residents and officials to understand the gap between how many people need affordable housing and how many affordable homes actually exist in the community. It can often be surprising to see that so many people in the community already are eligible for affordable housing, but may not actually have the opportunity to live in affordable housing, she said. Cape Cod and housing production plans. 7 of the 15 Cape Cod towns' housing production plans have expired. A list provided to the Times by the Massachusetts Executive Office of Housing and Livable Communities shows that housing production plans prepared by Barnstable, Yarmouth, Truro, Mashpee, Falmouth, Chatham, and Harwich have all lapsed. Orleans, Provincetown, and Edgartown do not have a current or expired plan. Dennis, Wellfleet, Sandwich, Brewster, Bourne, Eastham, Nantucket, and Oak Bluffs all have active housing production plans in place. Brewster, Nantucket, and Oak Bluffs also have plans that are certified by the state, meaning the plan was approved by the state and also the community has made progress on the plan. If certified, a community can achieve, quote, safe harbor, end quote, which means they now have the ability to remain more in control over the kind of housing developed in their community. Chapter 40B allows developers to override local zoning codes if at least 20% of the units built have long-term affordability restrictions. Once a community has reached the threshold of having 10% of its housing units classified as affordable, it has reached, quote, safe harbor, end quote, and is no longer subject to Chapter 40B. So if there is a proposal for a Chapter 40B development and it does not align with the community's goal for housing, then the town can reject the project. The amount of time for the safe harbor varies depending on how much progress the community makes on its housing production plan. None of the 15 towns on Cape Cod has reached the 10% threshold of housing units classified as affordable. Orleans, at 9.15%, is the closest to clearing the threshold, followed by Provincetown, at 8.03%, according to data in November. Approved housing production plans mean the community has approved it at the town planning board and select board level, followed by the state's approval. Choosing not to create a housing production plan. Orleans Affordable Housing Coordinator Marcia Algier said the town is not required by the state to have a housing production plan, and that the last official state housing inventory showed Orleans to be at 9.15%, just short of the 10% threshold under 40B. As a matter of fact, we are in the process of adding affordable housing units so that we expect to exceed the 10% threshold with the next SHI, or Subsidized Housing Inventory, update, said Algier in an email to the Times. One low-key housing tax credit project in Orleans by developer Penrose will renovate the building on West Road, which formerly housed a Cape Cod 5 operations center, into 62 apartments. Demolition and construction started in December, with the development expected to be done in 2025. A second project with 14 units is expected to start construction in the spring, said Algier. Algier noted that the state ultimately determines whether a town has exceeded the 10% threshold. While the town estimates its latest projects will get it over that hurdle, the denominator, or total number of year-round housing units, could change, so they cannot be certain what that number is. 10% affordable housing benchmark. Provincetown has also decided to forgo a housing production plan. Town manager Alex Morse said the town has already identified a number of both publicly and privately owned properties to unlock new housing units. Developing a housing production plan can often be all-encompassing and oftentimes repeat similar processes that communities have been through, Morse said. Put frankly, housing production plans, unfortunately, are often weaponized by communities in regards to the state's low-income housing inventory, said Morse. In many cases, communities use housing production plans as a way to limit housing development once they hit 10%. Provincetown may hit benchmark, won't be, quote, mission accomplished, end quote. A little over 8% of Provincetown housing inventory is classified as affordable as of June 29th, according to the state's subsidized housing inventory. Morse said the town is expected to bump past the 10% benchmark in the next 2 years, but, quote, that certainly isn't mission accomplished, end quote. Instead, the town, along with the Town Community Housing Council, has entered into a contract with University of Massachusetts Amherst Donahue Institute to examine housing needs, he said. A core component of a traditional housing production plan that assesses the specific needs of residents. The goal will be to assess who in the community needs housing, whether the housing is secure among that population, income levels, what types of units are needed, and other key questions. Having such information is intended to help town officials make better decisions on the type of developments that are needed. When we look at what a housing production plan consists of, it's really the needs assessment component of a production plan that is most important to us and the most critical information we need to continue our planning processes, said Morse. Provincetown will begin outreach on a community survey to determine what the town needs for housing. All Provincetown residents are invited to participate. Data tells us the numbers. McPherson said Chatham's last housing production plan focused on affordable housing, as the plans are linked to Chapter 40B, which centers on affordable housing production. As the town crafts its new housing production plan, she said town officials want to understand the need for housing for those earning up to 200% area median income. That's an important change for our Cape communities because the affordability gap on the Cape is so high because of all the pressures of second homes and short-term rentals. It just makes it so much harder for our workforce to be able to afford housing here, said McPherson. Heller said community engagement is a key part of creating the production plan. Data tells us the numbers. It's important to understand people's lived experiences and put life to those numbers, said Heller. The picture that goes with this story is of a large building. The caption reads, "The town of Orleans does not have a state-approved housing production plan, but the town does have the highest percentage of housing inventory that is affordable of all 15 Cape Cod towns. A housing project that began in December on West Road will create 62 apartments in 2025, boosting the percentage even higher," said Orleans Affordable Housing Coordinator Marcia Algier. Our next local story in today's Cape Cod Times is entitled, "Attorney General, Dozens of Guns Seized from East Falmouth Home," by Zane Razak, Cape Cod Times, USA Today Network. A 46-year-old East Falmouth man was arrested on February 29th after a multi-agency investigation into his alleged unlawful possessions of weapons, including 7 AR-15-style assault rifles, according to a press release from the Attorney General Andrea Joy Campbell's office. Scott LePan pleaded not guilty the next day in Falmouth District Court, according to the clerk's office. Following a hearing, he was determined to be a danger to the public and ordered held without bail until the case is resolved. LePan's attorney, Patrick K. Dobert, told The Times that the case against Scott is not remotely about violent crime or gun violence. "It's about obsessive gun control and criminalizing fundamental rights through government overreach, said Dolbert in an email. Mr. LePan is appealing the district court's finding of dangerousness and order of pretrial detention to the Superior Court on Friday morning in Barnstable. After obtaining a search warrant, investigators searched his home, where, beside the seven AR-15-style weapons, authorities found an AK-47 rifle and hundreds of rounds of various caliber ammunition and two silencers. LePan faces 46 gun-related charges, including 6 counts of possession of an assault weapon, 14 counts of possession of a gun without license to carry / firearms identification card, and 23 counts of possession of large capacity weapon / feeding device. Possession of an assault weapon carries a mandatory minimum prison sentence of 1 year. Possession of a large capacity weapon / feeding device carries a mandatory minimum prison sentence of 2.5 years. LePan was also charged with 2 counts of possession of a silencer and possession of ammunition without license to carry / firearms identification card. Led in part by Homeland Security Investigations, New England Cybercrimes Group, and the Attorney General's Office, the investigation found that LePan had purchased about 50 firearms-related items, according to the press release. Assistant Attorney General Lynn Brennan of the Attorney General's Enterprise and Major Crimes Division is handling the matter. In a statement to the Times, the Attorney General's office said Massachusetts boasts some of the strongest gun laws in the country, but, quote, there are still instances of gun violence ravaging our communities, end quote. Attorney General Campbell is committed to tackling the issue of gun violence head on by directing her Gun Violence Prevention Unit and Criminal Bureau to leverage existing tools, such as pushing for legislation to close loopholes, engaging the community, and not hesitating to prosecute illegal gun trafficking, reads the statement. A probable cause hearing is set for March 29th, according to the clerk's office. And now we'll go to the stories on the Cape and Islands page of today's Cape Cod Times. The first story is entitled, Failed Pump, Heavy Rain Lead to Oil Spill Near Duck Creek in Wellfleet. By Heather McCarron, Cape Cod Times, USA Today Network. A fuel oil spill at Mid-Cape Home Centers, 30 Commercial Street in Wellfleet, kept first responders busy from Sunday night into the early morning hours Monday as they worked to ensure no contamination made it into the nearby Duck Creek Marsh, which feeds into Wellfleet Harbor. Fire Chief Rich Pauley on Monday said the Wellfleet Fire Department responded to the Home Improvement Center just past 8 p.m. on Sunday after a report of a mixture of fuel oil and water leaking from an 8,500-gallon above-ground recovery tank on the site. The temporary tank was installed about 3 weeks ago after a 270-gallon heating tank used for heating the home center failed, the chief said. The building itself sits on a slab, he explained, but the heating tank is behind the building, quote, in a vault area below ground, end quote. This situation was created to pump out that heating tank that let go and any of the subground surface water to get that out of the environment, Polly said, noting that spill is contained. For whatever reason, the pump didn't cycle itself off. It kept pumping into the big 8,500-gallon tank. So between the pump being a problem over the weekend and the amount of rain we've had, it overcapacitated the big tank. Overflow into the parking lot, the street, and a storm drain. He said the collected mix of water and fuel oil seeped through the top of the big tank, which is closed off by a hatch, quote, overflowing into the parking and then into the street, end quote, and then into a nearby storm drain. The fire department estimates no more than 15 gallons of fuel got into the storm drain system, and it was confined to the drain under Commercial Street. But for extra assurances, several storm drains were examined and quickly pumped out before the tide, quote, to ensure that the fuel water mix did not migrate into the marsh and harbor, end quote. A combination of speedy dry, absorbent pads, and booms were used to capture the fuel oil. In addition to the fire department, the State Department of Environmental Protection, Wellfleet Police Department, the Town Department of Public Works, and the Town Harbormaster's Department all responded to the scene, as well as a private environmental cleanup company, Weston and Sampson. About 5 hours to contain the fuel oil. Responders were on site for about 5 hours, finishing up between midnight and 1 a.m. Monday, Polly said. Responders were quick to act to ensure the integrity of waters that feed into Wellfleet's shellfish beds. That was our very first concern, he said. In consultation with others, the fire department believes that no fuel water mix escaped the town storm water drain system, and there is no damage to the marsh area or harbor as a result of the spill, Polly said. We're very confident we got all that pumped up last night, Polly said. I firmly believe that we do have it under control. For additional precaution, monitoring will continue, likely for a few months, Polly said. This will involve monitoring outflows into the marsh and harbor. A couple of observation wells have already been put in, he said. Monitoring will be done by the Environmental Response Cleanup Team, Fire Department, Wellfleet Health Department, and Wellfleet Conservation Department on a daily basis. And there is a picture on the Cape and Islands page, which is entitled Stranger in Paradise. The picture is of a seal on a beach, and the caption says, a harp seal takes advantage of a secluded sunny spot at the east end of Dowse's Beach overlooking Long Beach in Centerville. Barnstable Natural Resources Officer Chris Nappy says the rare to the Cape animal has been seen there for 3 days and is being monitored by wildlife officials who have posted signs to keep onlookers at a distance. And now in other local news, we will go to the obituaries. John J.R. Raymond Richard, South Dennis. John J.R. Raymond Richard, age 49, passed away from a tragic accident on March 4, 2024. He is survived by his twin children, Jenna and John Richard Jr., and their mother, Kathy Malkasian. Calling hours will be held on March 16th from 12:30 to 2 at the Leet-Stevens Enfield Chapels, 61 South Road, Enfield, Connecticut. Burial is private. There will also be a gathering of remembrance at Scargo Cafe in Dennis, Massachusetts, on March 24th from 11 to 1 p.m. In lieu of flowers, a scholarship fund for his children has been set up at this GoFundMe account, www.gofund.me/1C0A6F31. To share online condolences, please visit www.leetstevens.com. Carol Linda Roth, Orleans. Carol Roth faded from this world with her children by her side on Sunday morning, March 10th, 2024. Carol devoted much of her time to many worthwhile local Cape organizations where she will be missed, such as Cape Cod Hospital Auxiliary, Cape Cod Synagogue, and Am Hayam. Her funeral service will be held on Wednesday, March 13th, 2024, at 10 a.m. at the Cape Cod Synagogue. Her burial will follow at the Orleans Cemetery, Orleans, Massachusetts. Donations in her honor may be made to Am Hayam Jewish Congregation, Carol and Stephen Roth Food Drive, Post Office Box 1235, Brewster, Massachusetts 02631, or Lower Cape Outreach Council Pantry, 19 Brewster Cross Road, Orleans, Massachusetts, 02653. For online condolences, please visit www.nickersonfunerals.com. Gavin Road Curran, Martha's Vineyard. It is with deep sadness that we announce the death of Gavin Road Curran on February 15, 2024, in Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts. A visiting hour will be held at the Chapman Funerals and Cremations, 98 Bedford Street, Bridgewater, Massachusetts, on Friday, March 15th, from 5 to 6 p.m., followed by a brief funeral service at the funeral home. All are invited. A celebration of Gavin's life will be held later in the spring. All will be welcome. In lieu of flowers, a donation in Gavin's name may be made to Massachusetts Association for Mental Health at www.nhmh.org mamh.org. Virginia M. Baker, Buzzards Bay. Virginia M. Baker, age 95, of Buzzards Bay, passed away on March 10, 2024, at Keystone Place. She is survived by her two daughters, Leslie Cook and Lauren Schilling, and their families. A memorial visitation will be held on Friday, March 15th, from 1 to 4 p.m., with a service to be held at 3:30 p.m. in the funeral home. Please visit www.nickersonbornfuneralhome.com for directions, online condolences, and to read the full obituary. Edward Blank, Jr., West Yarmouth. Edward, or Ed, Blank, Jr., age 93, of West Yarmouth, Massachusetts, passed away peacefully on February 23, 2024, at the Cape Cod Hospital. A private burial at Massachusetts National Cemetery, Bourne, Massachusetts. Donations may be made to the Massachusetts Audubon Society. Isabel Margaret Susie Reeves, East Dennis. Isabel Margaret Susie Reeves, formerly of East Dennis, died peacefully on March 10, 2024. She was the beloved wife of the late Richard C. Reeves, Sr. Visiting hours will be held in the Doan, Beale, and Ames Funeral Home, 729 Route 134, South Dennis, on Thursday, March 14, 2024, from 11 o'clock a.m. to 1 o'clock p.m., with a brief funeral service beginning at 1 p.m. Burial will take place on Friday, March 15, 2024, at 11 o'clock a.m. in Quivet Neck Cemetery, East Dennis. For complete obituary, visit www.doanbealeamesdennis.com. And now we'll go back to the front page for a Massachusetts state news story. Battle Brews Over Tipped Worker Wages by Chris Lisinski, Statehouse News Service. Adding to an election cycle already bound to feature prominent labor-related fights, a national campaign and an influential restaurant industry group will compete for votes over how tipped workers in Massachusetts should be paid. Lawmakers will gavel in a hearing Tuesday about a proposed ballot question that would eliminate the separate lower minimum wage for tipped workers, wading into a topic with clear battle lines and similar campaigns unfolding in three other states. The proposal pits two well-organized sides, against one another. Proponents argue that many servers, bartenders, and other tipped employees regularly fail to achieve minimum wage when combining their base pay and gratuities, while opponents warn that the change would carry, quote, a devastating impact on the industry, end quote. One Fair Wage, which says it represents nearly 300,000 restaurant and service workers, is supporting ballot questions in Massachusetts, Michigan, Ohio, and Arizona that would require employers to pay all waitstaff, bartenders, and other workers their state's full minimum wage, not the lower rate offered for those who can earn gratuities. Saru Jayaraman, president of One Fair Wage, said the group previously spent about a decade unsuccessfully pushing legislation in Massachusetts to pay workers a full minimum wage with tips on top before one of its sponsors, Senator Patricia Jalen, suggested we go to the ballot. One Fair Wage ran successful campaigns in Washington, D.C. and in Chicago, Jayaraman said. So leaders felt the time was right, especially as they continue to hear reports of workers failing to achieve a full minimum wage once accounting for tips. Workers in Massachusetts who've been with us for a long time felt like we can't wait any longer, Jayaraman said. People are seeing change in a lot of different places on this issue. We've been trying this for so long, we're not getting anywhere. Massachusetts law requires all employers to pay workers at least $15 an hour under the, quote, grand bargain, end quote, package the legislature brokered to avert other ballot questions in 2018. But they can pay tipped workers $6.75 per hour as long as the tips bring each individual's total pay up to at least $15 annually. Excuse me, $15 hourly. The question would gradually increase what employers must pay tipped workers over 5 years until it mirrors the same minimum rate of pay for workers of all stripes. It would not ban tipping. Employees who collect gratuities today would still be able to do that under the proposal. The money would just be on top of at least $15 per hour from their employer, instead of contributing to that $15 per hour. Jayaraman said the new model would be, quote, better for customers, end quote, because they would know their gratuities are additional bonuses for servers and other staff rather than part of their base pay. When you tip in Massachusetts, you think your tips are an extra bonus on top of the wage. You think you're rewarding good service. But in fact, your tips are being used to cover the employer's costs, she said. It's basically employers taking your tips and using them to cover their costs for what every other employer is required to do, which is to pay a minimum wage. The measure has generated less intense policy fights so far this cycle than some other ballot questions. But the battle lines became clear over the past week as opponents formed their own fundraising arm, pushed survey results they say undercut support for the measure, and scheduled a press conference to try to amplify their concerns. That's all on top of a lawsuit plaintiffs, including Massachusetts Restaurant Association President Steve Clark, filed last month, which asked the state's highest court to toss the measure by arguing that it improperly mixed topics. Clark argued the idea would increase costs for restaurants, which typically have narrow operating margins, and result in higher menu prices for diners. restaurants aren't walking around with an extra $100,000 in costs that they could just pass on to the consumer. So not only is it going to result in higher prices, but it's going to involve less profitability. And restaurants right now are probably at the lowest profitability rating that they've ever seen, he said. Seven other states require employers to pay the same minimum wage to all workers, regardless of whether they earn tips. Alaska, California, Minnesota, Montana, Nevada, Oregon, and Washington. Clark argued that those states are not a good comparison because their pay models have been in place for decades. On Monday, the Massachusetts Restaurant Association publicized results of a new survey, which it paid about $17,000 to commission, according to Clark. That suggested most tipped employees in Massachusetts restaurants like the status quo. Comcore Inc., a research and consulting firm with headquarters in Pittsburgh, in February, conducted an online survey of 351 tipped employees at full-service restaurants in Massachusetts. The firm found that 86% of Bay State tipped workers somewhat or strongly agree that the existing model works well for them and does not need change. Nearly 9 in 10 said they earn $20 per hour or more, and more than half reported earning $30 per hour. The tipped employees are already the highest earners in the restaurant. So all you're doing is taking a dollar per hour that you may be paying to a dishwasher or a line cook, and now you're putting it in the pocket of the employee who's making the most money, Clark said. Another provision in the ballot question that's landed in the spotlight would allow employers who pay a full minimum wage to administer a, quote, tip pool, end quote, which would combine gratuities earned by all workers and distribute it evenly, including to those who did not receive tips. The Massachusetts Restaurant Association argued in court that the measure is too different from the underlying wage proposal, making the question ineligible for the ballot. Jayaraman said tip sharing, which she added is currently banned by state law, even if an employer pays the standard minimum wage to all workers, quote, creates a better sense of unity and team, end quote, between the front and back of the house in restaurants and bars. The idea has already split potentially influential third parties. As Commonwealth Beacon reported, Unite Here Local 26 leaders support the idea of employers paying all tipped workers a full minimum wage, but oppose the pooled tip provision. Clark and his allies signaled they are prepared to continue the fight into November. Opponents of the measure formed a campaign fundraising and spending committee, dubbed the Committee to Protect Tips, last week. And in the face of opposition from restaurants, Jayaraman said she is not surprised. This is the same exact fight we've had for 13 years in, like, 20 states. They always use the same arguments and the same tactics. It's never any different, she said. We feel incredibly prepared, and frankly, we've been winning. We won in D.C., we won in Chicago, we won in Flagstaff, Arizona. The tipped minimum wage proposal is not the only potential 2024 ballot question fight that could pit a worker-friendly campaign against major industry figures. Two of the most high-profile measures in the mix take aim at the relationship between platforms like Uber and Lyft and their fleet of drivers, likely with national repercussions. One would give drivers the ability to unionize and collectively bargain. The other, backed by the companies, seeks to define drivers as independent contractors instead of workers, a move that the Attorney General alleges is a violation of existing state law, while providing them some new benefits. And next we'll go to our front page national news story, which is entitled Inflation and Price Pressures Stay High, by Paul Davidson, USA Today. Consumer prices in the United States picked up last month, a sign that inflation remains a persistent challenge for the Federal Reserve and for President Joe Biden's re-election campaign, both of which are counting on a steady easing of price pressures this year. Prices rose 0.4% from January to February, higher than the previous month's figure of 0.3%, the Labor Department said Tuesday. Compared with a year earlier, consumer prices rose 3.2% last month, above January's 3.1% annual pace. Excluding volatile food and energy prices, so-called, quote, core prices, end quote, also climbed 0.4% from January to February, matching the previous month's rise and a faster pace than is consistent with the Fed's 2% inflation target. Core inflation is watched especially closely because it typically provides a better read of where inflation is likely headed. It's a disappointment, but not a disaster, said Eric Winograd, U.S. economist at asset manager AB. The underlying details are more encouraging than the top-line number, which was boosted by a few volatile categories, the type of prices that tend not to repeat month to month. Those volatile items included gas prices, which jumped 3.8% just from January to February, but are still below their level of a year ago. Airfares surged 3.6% after 2 months of much smaller increases. Clothing prices rose 0.6% after 3 months of declines, but are unchanged compared with a year earlier. Housing and rental costs, which tend to change more slowly, cooled in February. They rose 0.4% from January, slower than the 0.6% increase the previous month. Measures of new apartment leases, which have cooled, will likely feed into the government's inflation data in the coming months. New car prices ticked down 0.1% in February. Though these prices remain much higher than they were before the pandemic, they're expected to decline further as more vehicles show up on dealer lots. Grocery prices were unchanged last month and are just up 1% from a year earlier. Despite February's elevated figures, most economists expect inflation to continue slowly declining this year. At the same time, the uptick last month may underscore the Fed's cautious approach towards interest rate cuts. Voter perceptions of inflation are sure to occupy a central place in this year's presidential election. Despite a healthy job market and record-high stock market, polls show that many Americans blame Biden for the surge in consumer prices that began in 2021. Though inflationary pressures have significantly eased, average prices remain about far above where they stood 3 years ago. In his State of the Union speech last week, Biden highlighted steps he has taken to reduce costs, like capping the price of insulin for Medicare patients. The president also criticized many large companies for engaging in, quote, price gouging, end quote, and so-called shrinkflation, in which a company shrinks the amount of product inside a package rather than raising the price. Too many corporations raise prices to pad their profits, charging more and more for less and less, Biden said. Rob Considine, who lives near Minneapolis, said he had noticed shrinkflation in consumer products like deodorant, shampoo, and soap. Considine, age 38, said he doubts, though, that Biden's criticism of shrinkflation or proposals in Congress to restrict the practice will have much effect. If companies can't make bars of soap smaller while charging the same price, Considine suggested, they will simply reduce the quality to maintain their profits. I don't know how government can set a price for a commodity like that without affecting it in the long run, he said. Overall inflation has plummeted from a peak of 9.1% in June 2022, though it's now easing more slowly than it did last spring and summer. This has been Carolyn reading to you from the Cape Cod Times on Wednesday, March 13th. I hope you all have a great day.